On this week's program, Susan Lewis considers the art of June Kaneko, whose costumes and sets feature in the Opera Company Philadelphia's latest production, Madama Butterfly, and whose sculptures are on view in four different venues around the city. David Patrick Stern speaks with Michael Hirsch. The Philadelphia-based composer has an upcoming world premiere performance of an evening-length work for French horn and cello, and a soon-to-be-released CD of his cello sonatas. And we speak with Temple University professor Brian Simon. His new book examines the socioeconomic impact of Starbucks and what the global cafe chain says about community, status, and personal identity in contemporary America. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In 1904, Italian composer Giacomo Puccini created the opera Madama Butterfly, now among the most performed works in the repertoire. Today, Japanese-born artist Jun Kaneko, who now lives in Nebraska, is known around the world, particularly for his large-scale ceramic sculptures. Now, as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports, Kaneko's contemporary art and Puccini's classic opera meet in a new production, which itself is part of a citywide celebration of Kaneko's art.
In recent weeks, people passing through City Hall's courtyard will have come literally face-to-face with the art of June Kaneko. Two giant heads, each about 10 feet tall, one pink, the other black and white, stare at each other from opposite corners. Up the parkway at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Perlman Building, four oblong ceramic sculptures known as dangos, each 9 feet tall, appear to stand guard just outside the museum's galleries of photography and design. On one's rounded surface, dots bleed into lines. On others, color layers upon color. And down at the Kimmel Center, one dango, alone near the door, greets visitors entering from South Broad Street, while four other dangos appear to mingle in the lobby, dwarfing concertgoers.
When you look at small piece, I feel a different way than when I look at a huge mountain or tree.
Artist Jun Kaneko has been exploring through sculpture the emotional impact of scale.
And when I'm looking down, flower or small child, I don't know why my emotion changes. At that same time, I go into the big cathedral. I just look up inside. You feel completely different. And that has been my question for maybe last 25 years.
Nobody has ever done clay sculptures that big.
Suyan Lox is currently presenting a show of smaller Kaneko art at her commercial gallery on Washington Square. She's also worked with the artist studios to coordinate the citywide celebration.
But it wasn't me who started out. It's Opera Company. It was a fabric workshop.
Like the size of his sculptures, the artist's relationship with Philadelphia has grown over the years. He worked with the fabric workshop first in the 80s, then in 2005, when the Fabric Workshop produced his costumes for his first opera, Opera Omaha's production of Madama Butterfly. Last season, Kaneko designed Fidelio for the Opera Company of Philadelphia, which is now staging Madama Butterfly. Opera Company Executive Director David Devan says engaging a contemporary artist to design opera is a way of keeping the standard repertoire current.
In this case, we have a contemporary American-Japanese artist who brings a lot of aesthetic integrity to telling the story, but in a contemporary way that will be relevant and meaningful for audiences today.
June Kaneko found the task of creating art for opera the biggest challenge of his career in art.
It's a totally different thing. Painting and sculpture doesn't move by itself. Singer moves around, and then balance between the set and the costume, and then music and then lighting. It keeps on moving, sort of like trying to grab the running water on the stream.
E soffitto e pareti, quando e vengono a prova a norma che mi giova, nello stesso locale, alternar nuovi aspetti e consueti.
Madama Butterfly tells a story that references history but is also timeless. Boy meets girl. Boy leaves girl. Boy comes back, but, well, it's not a happy ending.
This role is one of opera's most famous cads.
Roger Honeywell plays the part of American Navy Lieutenant B.F. Pinkerton, who goes to Japan.
And he marries this young girl, Cho-Cho-san, and sort of shacks up with her for a little while, and then goes back to the United States, where he marries a real, true American woman. And he leaves Cho-Cho-san high and dry, and unbeknownst to him, with a baby. And then he comes back to retrieve the baby and steal him away from Cho-Cho-san. He's just a terrible human being.
Honeywell, who sang the same role in the original Kaneko production, was startled when he first arrived in Omaha to take on the dashing yet despicable Pinkerton.
I walked in and I saw this costume and I thought, they've got to be kidding. They're joking. This looks ridiculous. It had sort of patches on it and my shirt had polka dots and I just couldn't believe it. I thought, this guy hasn't read the play. I mean, I'm a naval officer. How could he do this?
Contemporary artist Kaneko had at first considered a realistic approach, but then had found himself drawn again to more abstract imagery. He likens the costume design to a sculptural issue.
Each singer's shape becomes a sculptural shape. And then in my case, I put lots of colors in different way. It has to contribute to make more exciting visual experience.
The visual experience is a stage awash with color, with vibrant oranges and deep blue backdrops, with bold forms suggesting the moon and the night sky, and sharp, clean lines making concentric circles on the floor. And when Roger Honeywell walked onto the set, his uniform didn't seem strange at all.
I thought, this guy is a genius. This is fantastic. I could inhabit this world that he'd created now because I fit in. I was an element of it.
Kaneko also uses modern technology, with video screens at one point projecting animated drawings. Opera executive director David Devan points to the humming chorus.
Midway through the opera, where our heroine is waiting for Pinkerton to return, there is a montage of what might be happening in her head that plays out on these three huge screens.
Like an opera, the citywide initiative, selecting, shipping, and installing 11 works, each weighing a ton, required collaboration and coordination. In this case, among the artist, Locke's Gallery, the city, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and the Kimmel Center. But the result? Art that may startle, surprise, and even stop foot traffic, even if people are not sure what they're looking at. Even if, as in most of Kaneko's work, there is no title.
Once you put the title on anything, you know, if I paint blue and on the canvas, if I say sky, it's really strong limitation of a viewer's freedom.
This was famous quote, you know, it doesn't complete until the audience responds. So whatever the artist made, and you as a viewer look at it, you're taking your own.
When you see these sculptures and you see people stopping at City Hall and looking and taking them in, you realize this is for the people. And that same message we'd like to overlay on Butterfly and anything else we produce.
Encounters with art, on the street, in a gallery, or in the opera house, require not an art degree, nor a musical background, just a willingness to stop and engage one's curiosity and emotions.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Madama Butterfly runs through Sunday, October 18th. Art by June Kaneko is on view at City Hall and the Kimmel Center until October 24th, at Locke's Gallery until October 31st, and at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Perelman Building through April 18th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Though Philadelphia composer Michael Hirsch has written major works for the Pittsburgh and St. Louis symphonies, and currently has high-profile commissions from the Cleveland Orchestra and star baritone Thomas Hampson, he spent the last several years at work on ambitious chamber music pieces that nobody is asking for. In fact, he's presenting his own premiere next Saturday of his 2-hour-plus, 41-movement piece Last Autumn, in what constitutes a sort of musical secret garden. The music is highly personal and so challenging it required a year of preparation. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports from a rehearsal for what could be a one-time-only event.
If you saw Michael Hirsch on an Amtrak train between his Philadelphia residence and the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, where he teaches, you might not take him for anybody extraordinary. He's a tall, willowy, nice-looking fellow in his mid-30s with a delightful wife and a young daughter. But during rehearsals this week, you'd see the composer not even looking at the score or at the musicians. No, he was in an adjoining room, standing, not sitting, looking at the wall, and not seeming to be very comfortable.
Well, walls can be very interesting, first of all. I've always struggled, and to this day I struggle, with the concept even of sharing the music that I write with an audience. I sometimes wonder why it is that I should have even the opportunity to air something so utterly private.
That's understandable. Though Hirsch is good at meeting deadlines and specific terms of a commission, his music isn't always appreciated or understood on first hearing. His 2005 Variations on a Theme by Hugo Wolf was booed lightly by a Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia audience. When he wrote Arache for the grand opening of the Strathmore Center outside of Washington, D.C., the general area where Hirsch grew up, he was given a cursory performance by conductor Yuri Temirkanov in what was described by critics as the wrong music for the wrong program. Only later did a recording by the Baltimore Symphony's current music director, Maren Alsop, show how compelling the piece is. No surprise that something as abstract and personal as this new work, Last Autumn, was written for the composer's most trusted collaborators, cellist Daniel Gaisford and Hirsch's hornist brother Jamie, who is a member of the Singapore Symphony Orchestra. It's safe to say that Last Autumn is the only 2-hour-plus piece ever written for the unorthodox pairing of horn and cello. Both players have been learning it for a year. Jamie even had a special hybrid horn built that would allow him to make hefty sounds while maintaining pitch-stable high notes. The music shows Hirsch taking stock, writing downright lyrical lullabies, tumultuous passages he calls psalms, while also acknowledging his love of fragmentary miniatures by Schumann and Chopin. In this work, Hirsch may well be hitting a new creative peak.
I've just found, over these past 10 years, I've found a way of working that I recognize what I need for myself to write the best that I can. And, you know, it's taken a while to find that space, but I think that I've found it. And I hope that each piece is just another step in a long staircase. I don't know where it all leads. But, you know, I feel like it's only been in the relatively recent past that I've reached something of adulthood as a composer.
Hirsch's music often has literary associations, though the nature of that association is rarely clear. The opening section of the piece has a haiku-like inscription by the little-known German poet W.G. Sebald that, for the two instrumentalists, aptly applies to the music, but not in a way that's obvious. While rifling through the score, Gaisford and Jamie Hirsch talk about the first movement's relationship between words and sound.
The first movement is a great example, but look, it's very simple. The air stirs the light. The is a very bright light, and it's shocking. I mean, that's what I mean. It's incredible to see what that evokes in the mind of a master.
Is like a tropical storm rushing into this, you know, massive swirling of nature. I don't know.
The luxury of having a living composer in your midst is that you can go to the source and ask. Not that it's going to do any good when the music is written so intuitively.
I love certain poets, certain writers, certain visual artists that I sort of carry around on the tip of my mind, and their work is, I would say, in a much more pronounced way than other music is. And so sometimes, especially in the last 15 years or so, a lot of times when I'm writing, very specific fragments of texts come to mind, and they just seem like companions. The text certainly doesn't need the music, and the music, I hope, doesn't need the text. But I hope by providing it to the listener that the experience of each is heightened somewhat by the presence of the other.
And then there's the music's pregnant silences. They're meticulously written into the score and considered to be an integral part. Somehow, the composer believes that they need to be there. Other passages are incredibly graphic and tumultuous. But what sort of life experience could have prompted such sounds?
I'd rather not say. I mean, I think that one of the great things about art, if it does communicate to another individual, is it allows the musical object or the whatever the art is to really be a mirror of sorts and allows the listener to see his or herself.
And if there's too much information about his story, the listeners will never find their own stories. Ultimately, Hirsch's music is a language unto itself, and the philosophical opposite of Richard Strauss's overtly descriptive tone poems. Sometimes it's best not to even talk about the music, but to just take it in. I've often experienced Hirsch's music, particularly newer pieces such as The Vanishing Pavilions, as some sort of esoteric spiritual ritual. No matter how many times you've done it, the experience is going to be new. There's no predicting where it'll lead. So it's best to just acquiesce.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns, cellist Daniel Gaisford, and hornist Jamie Hirsch performed the world premiere of Michael Hirsch's Last Autumn this coming Saturday at St. Mark's Church in Center City, Philadelphia. The latest book by Temple University history professor Brian Simon explores the social phenomena reflected in the growth of the Starbucks chain of cafes. Starbucks has grown from a single coffee shop in the Pike Place Market in Seattle in the 1970s to a global operation with more than $10 billion in revenue last year. In the course of researching Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks, Brian Simon visited more than 400 of its cafes in 9 countries. In the book, Simon proposes that as connections with communities receded, Starbucks presented an image of community which like-minded people could buy into, and that Starbucks came to represent many American aspirations in the early 21st century. When I spoke with Brian Simon recently, I first asked him why people were prepared to pay $3 to $4 for a cup of coffee that could be found for a fraction of that price elsewhere, or made at home for even less.
I think largely what's happened over the last 20 years is more and more of what we care about gets expressed through what we buy. And in part, that has to do with the kind of pulling back of other more fundamental institutions. So at the same time that this kind of more hyper-expression of buying took place, community relations start to recede, neighborhoods start to recede, our own sense of politics and the kind of meaning of politics starts to recede, or what's possible in the formal political system. And buying oozes almost, and I use the kind of oozing metaphor in the book, into every place that other institutions vacate. So that's sort of the fundamental premise. So what the things we want, probably aren't that surprising. I mean, we want something that seems real, something that seems sort of unique to us. Increasingly, we do that through buying. We want a sort of predictability. We live in a world of constant motion, of constant dislocation, of constantly not really knowing where we are. And that created a kind of desire for predictability. We want community. We want, I think, a sense of discovery, particularly people who are kind of upper middle class, want this sense of kind of constant learning and that they know something other people don't know. And also we seem to want a kind of greener world, a world where, you know, nature can sort of shine and we're not taken from it. And we seem to want to not leave in the wake of 9/11 such an onerous footprint around the rest of the world. And, you know, we want other things, but those are the wants, the desires that I saw sort of imprinted in Starbucks and then what Starbucks sold back to us.
And it was cynically set up, and it was a branding decision to actually go out and try and satisfy those needs, or it just evolved to be a one-stop shop for all the things you just mentioned?
You know, I don't know about how sinister it was, but we don't need much of what we buy. We constantly are buying things we don't need. Even if you're addicted to caffeine, you don't need to spend $4 for a cup of coffee. But brands and companies have to figure out a way to make things we don't need seem essential. So in order to do that, what they do is laden what they sell with multiple promises and multiple meaning. Starbucks understood that. I mean, I think branders are pretty explicit about that. And I quote in the book, one brander says, you know, look, people need community. We're going to give it to them. But they can't really fulfill it. And they're not really interested in fulfilling it. They're only interested in satisfying the kind of initial instinct. And part of what I'm trying to get at here is that there's models of buying that sort of says, look, we're all dupes. And there's other models of buying that says, oh, we're in total control. And what we get is somewhere in the middle, where Starbucks is constantly moving in order to anticipate and then match the desires of its consumers, desires that are produced through social, political, and economic changes. But on the other hand, they're not always ahead of the curve. Sometimes they have to play catch-up, and sometimes they are ahead of things. I mean, the coffee part, the sort of desire for authenticity, the desire for something real, they kind of were ahead of that curve. They kind of are behind the curve, probably, on the idea of what we want in the global world. So each desire has a little bit of a different story, but I do think that, you know, they do, I suspect. I mean, I had limited contact with the company, but they do, like other brands, they do all kinds of focus groups, they do all kinds of market research, they do ethnographic research. In a lot of ways, they do what I do to try and discover what people are thinking about. And
but they do what you do, but they also do what every other company, any company worth its salt, does. When I was reading the book, I was struck by the fact that ostensibly, I thought that they were kind of doing what the Hard Rock Cafe did in the 1980s, which is to sell you two cheap commodities and to tie them up in some sort of idea of celebrity or community or whatever it was, i.e. that the Hard Rock Cafe was selling you beer and burgers, things you could buy at a fast food place for a dollar, and they were selling it to you for $10, and they were wrapping it up. Instead of it being community and ecology and all of these things, they were sticking guitars on the walls and giving the impression that this is where rock stars ate.
Right.
And what's the difference?
There isn't, actually. And that's an important part of what I'm trying to get at. I say at the very beginning of the book that what I'm interested about in Starbucks is not its uniqueness, but its typicality. It is in some ways epitomizes something very typical of the way companies operate in what I call the post-need order. So that in order to charge a premium, you have to offer something to people that they can take away, that they can use to represent themselves. So what people do at the Hard Rock Cafe is, I saw a rock and roll museum. I touched Jimi Hendrix's guitar.
And I bought a T-shirt.
And I'm willing to pay the premium for that so that you know that. McDonald's, on the other hand, has a harder time selling that sort of premium, right? They have to sell you something functional. So if you want to charge more, you have to offer people something else and something that they can use then to represent themselves to other people.
And the T-shirt in the Starbucks case was, you're walking down the street and you've got that mask, green mask on your white coffee cup.
And at a certain point in time, that said that I was someone successful. I'm someone discerning. I'm someone who knows about better things. I'm someone who cares about the environment and the global commodity chain.
Has that changed?
Yeah, I think it's changed pretty dramatically.
Because of?
Well, I think it's a kind of complicated thing, but the first thing I'd say is it's not a product of the current economic crisis.
Ah.
And a fair amount of ink has been spent on this, saying that, you know, Starbucks is a metaphor for the decline of the economy. I would argue, and I do in the book, that Starbucks actually started to tumble before the current economic crisis. And why? Because most of the cultural capital had been bled out of the cup. What do I mean by that? You no longer look so hip carrying a Starbucks cup in 2007. People didn't mistake you for someone who had any inside knowledge. People didn't mistake you for someone who was discerning. They sort of identified you as someone in the middle of the road.
Because everybody was doing it.
Because everybody was doing it. Once that happened, it became much harder for Starbucks to charge the premium. And that brought them into competition with McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts.
Who in the meantime, were producing their own premium.
They were sort of upscaling a little bit themselves. And that's a partially result of Starbucks. Starbucks had raised coffee standards for everybody. In order to sell coffee anymore to the kind of broad middle, you couldn't sell just brown water anymore. You had to make that better. And they were responding.
Or the appearance of it being better.
Yeah, and actually, for the most part, it is. I mean, at least
so a couple of McDonald's coffees better now than it was 3 years ago.
At least they're using higher quality beans and paying more attention to the way that they produce them. No doubt. I mean, it's less freeze packed. Yeah. So it's
a better product.
It's a better product now.
So a good thing came out of
when
all
you
this.
Douse it with milk and sugar. Who can tell the difference, anyways?
Right,
but
right.
That's another story. So, but part of what I'm saying is, again, business writers misunderstood this. They blame Starbucks' fall on competition from Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's. But it was only after Starbucks fell that Starbucks found itself in competition with Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's. And I sort of liken Starbucks now to, like, the Gap.
This is the major clothes retailer.
The major clothes retailer. Nobody goes to the Gap thinking it'll elevate their sense of status, probably. But they know by wearing a pair of Gap chinos and a Gap shirt, they're not going to lower their status. It keeps them in the middle.
And they know what they're getting.
They know what they're getting. There's predictability. And there's discounting, which increasingly Starbucks is doing now that it's fallen. So again, I would suggest that Starbucks falls before the economic crisis by the same logic that helped start it in the first place. People paid the premium because it said something about themselves that made them look better.
The tone of the book, to my mind, was extremely critical of Starbucks. Do you think that they acted immorally? Do you think what they did was wrong? Do you think they hoodwinked the American, the great gullible American public? Or are they simply just doing business?
Well, they're simply doing business, but business is increasingly a business of illusions. And they're an illusion maker in many cases.
But it surely isn't that what this entire country thrives on? We got Hollywood, we got rock and roll, we got all of these dream-building industries. Why is it not any different to try and sell somebody a cup of dream coffee or a dream in a coffee cup?
I don't want to suggest that it's fundamentally different. What I'd say is different about Starbucks is they promise a lot. Lots of companies sell illusions. Lots of companies sell dreams. And some of them make them really obvious. I mean, there's something really obvious, right, about Disney. I mean, they announce from the very beginning that it's an illusion. Many of the places in Las Vegas create illusions to sell illusions. And, you know, hoodwink or not, I mean, that's part of what they're doing. They're not pretending to be something else. There's something slightly different to me about the kind of earnestness of Starbucks' promises against maybe where they don't match up. And again, I'm not claiming that they're unique in this. Lots of companies are selling promises or are in the business of illusion making. And Starbucks happens to be the one that I decided to pay attention to in this book. What Starbucks did was sell an everyday kind of illusion about ourselves and about the world we lived in.
Temple University history professor Brian Simon. Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks, is published by the University of California Press. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.